The final case for oral argument this term would be the State of South Dakota versus Arvind Auberg. For the appellant, State of South Dakota is Mr. Stephen Blair, an attorney from Peer. And for the appellee, Mr. Auberg is Mr. Brian G. Hall, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Blair, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. As the Chief Justice has stated, I am Steve Blair with the Attorney General's Office in Peer, representing the state today on this case. The issue presented by the state's intermediate appeal is a relatively simple one. It's whether law enforcement had reasonable suspicion to stop the defendant on the night he was arrested. Briefly, the facts of the case are that on January of 2005, the defendant drove to a local bar in Sioux Falls. When he arrived at the bar, Officer Kelderman of the Sioux Falls Police Department was on the scene assisting another law enforcement officer who was taking a stolen vehicle report. Through the rearview mirrors of his patrol vehicle, Officer Kelderman saw the defendant pull into the parking lot. He did not witness any erratic or impaired driving. He did notice that the defendant had a difficult time exiting his vehicle. From there, Officer Kelderman observed the defendant walk across the ice-covered parking lot of the bar for about 30 feet. It was Officer Kelderman's testimony at the suppression hearing that Mr. Auberg was walking with an abnormally slow gait and seemed to have problems with his balance, that he had come close to falling down, and that in Officer Kelderman's opinion, he was staggering a bit. At this point, Officer Kelderman testified that he felt that the difficulty the defendant was having in walking was more due to more than just the ice on the surface of the parking lot, and he suspected at that point that Mr. Auberg had driven under the influence, and so he initiated the stop of the defendant. He asked the defendant if he had any medical conditions and whether he had been drinking. The defendant replied that he had been drinking earlier in the day and that he had a prosthetic left leg. Consequently, the defendant was arrested that night for second offense DUI. These facts came before a magistrate at a suppression hearing, at which time she found that Officer Kelderman only testified to general observations that did not rise to the level of reasonable suspicion, and she entered the suppression order based on that conclusion. The state today...
If we reverse her, aren't we just about telling everybody that that the officer's always right, and anything he observes or claims to observe is Bible?
I don't think it sends a message that the officer is always right. I think under the reasonable suspicion standard, it's the totality of the circumstances that need to be looked at. And I think where the magistrate erred is when she found that only general observations were made. In reality, there's a laundry list of circumstances that the officer took into account. I think the message you'd be sending is that Officer Kelderman here did exactly what we want law enforcement to do. He observed the circumstances that existed that night. He brought his training and experience to bear on those circumstances, and then he came to a conclusion that he suspected criminal activity. I think all the lines of the reasonable suspicion cases state that that's essentially what we want law enforcement to do, not operate on a hunch, but yet operate under their training experience too.
Did the magistrate make a finding of credibility as to the officer, that he was believable or not believable?
I don't think she used those exact words in the record. She made a statement, again, the general observation statement. She also said that I believe it was on the record that she said something along the lines of, to the state's attorney, I know you want to get more out of him. He's just not, you know, relating it the way you want. I don't think she ever, you know, said one way or another that I believe him or I don't believe him.
She did say that Mr. Auberg did not weave, stumble, or fall down. And that's a little bit contradictory to what the officer said, who said he was close to falling down, he was staggering a little bit. So obviously she didn't believe everything that he said. Is that a fair statement?
Looking at that part of the record, I think that would be a fair statement. I would argue.
Are we free then to look at the record ourselves and say, well, we disagree with the magistrate and we believe what the officer said, even though she didn't?
Well, the standard, her findings of fact would be reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. However, the court itself is free to make the de novo review of the conclusion as a reasonable suspicion. I think you can find that she clearly erred if you're convinced upon a total reading of the record that a mistake was made, and then reach the conclusion as to reasonable suspicion or not yourselves.
Do you see personally that the time and the place are crucial here? I mean, what if he got out of the car at high noon and limped into the USD School of Law?
I think the time and the place are circumstances that law enforcement take into account. Obviously, if I walk out of my house or any one of us walks out of our house and slips on our sidewalk, you know, that should not give the police officer the legal authority to come up and start questioning us. However, if it's 10 o'clock at night, as in this case, in a parking lot of a bar, you know, these are all circumstances that need to be taken into account. Again, what we ask law enforcement to do under the reasonable suspicion standard.
The difference here in a lot of the other cases we've heard is that he's walking into the bar, not coming out of it. Is that a significant difference? Does that mean then they can look at anybody that's walking into a bar?
I wouldn't say it's a significant difference. I would say that just the mere fact that he's walking into the bar should not negate reasonable suspicion. Many times you have people driving drunk to a bar.
I understand, but he did not observe any driving problems.
No.
And he saw him drive in.
Yeah, he saw him driving, but the circumstances after the defendant got out of the car led to the suspicion that he'd been driving under the influence. And I think whether he's walking into or out of a bar is certainly a circumstance to look at, but shouldn't, just because he's walking in, it should not negate the reasonable suspicion conclusion.
Other than the difficulty getting out of the car and slipping on the ice or almost falling on the ice, did he observe anything else about him? His physical, once he found out that he had a prosthesis, was there any observations other than that? Did he smell alcohol on him or anything like that that would have supported his original suspicion?
I would submit there's two different points in time that we're looking at under your question, Your Honor, is one is the initial stop, and that's what the suppression hearing was on. The other one is the continuation of the stop, and I think that's where the prosthesis, and there was some inference that the officer may have smelled alcohol at the suppression hearing. It was not getting into, there was some objection by trial counsel, but the prosthesis and the alcohol, I will concede, really should not play into account as far as the initial stop.
Your argument seems to be that the magistrate considered some facts but not the totality of the circumstances. Which specific facts were not considered by the magistrate that support a reasonable suspicion?
Well, I would say in her findings of fact, she lays out the facts. In my reading of her findings and conclusions, it doesn't seem that she relies on those in coming to her decision. The part that stands out to me is her statement that the officer only made general observations. And I think when you review the totality of the facts that presented themselves that night, he relayed all those to the magistrate at the suppression hearing. The time of, you know, it was 10 o'clock at night, it was in January, less than ideal weather conditions. Yeah, he witnessed the defendant have problems getting out of his vehicle. He watched him walk for 30 feet, during which he saw him stagger, fall, have problems with his balance. All that was related to the magistrate at the suppression hearing, and yet in her findings and conclusions, it seems to me that she relies on the one statement that the officer only gave general observations. And that, I think, is where she erred, that while he was testifying, present the laundry list as I have here, they all were presented to the magistrate. I think that's where she erred in her findings and conclusions and ultimately erred in not finding reasonable suspicion. As has been pointed out here, she did enter the finding that, you know, there was no weaving or however it was worded. I think that would be in direct contradiction to the testimony of the officer.
Isn't that the point that she made findings of fact that he didn't bob, weave, or fall down? And aren't they then clearly erroneous if you believe the officer's testimony that he almost fell down and that he appeared to be under the influence of something he didn't know what it was?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. The findings on that issue were clearly erroneous. That the officer testified to A and the magistrate found B without a finding that the officer was uncredible. They just don't match.
So we would have to find that part of her findings were clearly erroneous in order to rule in your favor. Is that correct?
If you agree, I don't think you necessarily have to find that the findings were clearly erroneous. I think you can look at it, the case as a whole, and if you're firmly convinced that a mistake has been made, you can find that the magistrate erred, and then reach your conclusion as to reasonable suspicion.
Well, she also makes a determination that the officer was basing the seizure on mere whim, caprice, and idle curiosity.
Again, that's where I feel that she has concluded wrongly. If you look at the facts as they're testified to, it's clear that Officer Kelderman didn't base his stop on a hunch. To me, an officer basing a stop on a hunch is, I'm a small-town police officer, I see a group of high school kids driving down the street, and I stop them because it's 10 o'clock at night and high school kids might be drinking, with no other, facts that would lead me to stop that vehicle. That, to me, is an unconstitutional stop based on a hunch. Here, the officer had a list of facts that he took into account, used his training and experience on to decide that the ice, the difficulty in walking was more than just the ice, and then made the stop based on that reasonable suspicion.
What was the testimony about the ice, the weather condition at that time?
I believe the officer testified that I don't remember whether he said very icy or if he just said icy.
Does that make a difference?
Ice is ice.
Well, most people are going to slip and slide around on ice when they're getting out of their vehicle.
Yes, that is true.
So why does that rise to a level of suspicion?
Because, again, the officer did exactly what we want law enforcement to do. Officer Kelderman at this time had 2.5 years of experience as a law enforcement officer and had dealt with hundreds of drunken driving situations. And he observed the defendant and the circumstances that were presented to him, and he came to the inference that, based on his training experience, that it was more than the ice that was causing the difficulty in walking.
What if he'd have been pulled up to the local Hy-Vee parking lot and got out and had the same problem? Does that then give the officer also enough suspicion to seize him?
I would argue that if the officer was there and came to the same conclusion that Officer Kelderman did, that it was more than the ice causing the problem, then the officer would have reasonable suspicion to make that initial contact. I think it's important also to remember that the balance struck in Terry and the line of cases since then have been between the citizen's right to be free of search and seizures and law enforcement's right to carry out their obligation to prevent crime. And Terry and the cases that have followed have allowed the minimal intrusion based on reasonable suspicion, and then you need something to carry on from there further. In this case, if the officer had stopped the defendant and the defendant had related to him that I have a prosthetic limb, and the officer had not smelled alcohol, and the defendant had not admitted he had been drinking earlier, I would say that the stop should have ended right there. But in this case, the officer cannot observe the prosthetic limb when he saw him walking. He makes the stop. The defendant admits to drinking alcohol. The officer smells it on him. And I think that is what gives him the legal authority to continue the stop for the DUI investigation.
Is there any distinction, because this conversation or whatever you want to call it takes place in a public parking lot versus a semi-public place or a private place?
I would say that your expectation of being in a private place, your expectation of being free from this type of activity, I would say, is greater. in a public parking lot, obviously, you know, the defendant had no expectation that, you know, what the way he was walking or the fact that he had been drinking was somehow private. It was a public place. The officer was there lawfully carrying out his duties on another call when he witnessed these circumstances. I think that is a another circumstance that comes into play when reaching reasonable suspicion or not. I would just like to, a couple more things to point out. One is, all of these circumstances taken separately appear totally innocent. The cases, however, have held that law enforcement, through their training, is given the ability, we expect them to take innocent circumstances, pull them together in one sort of situation, and then decide whether there's reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is occurring. I think it would be erroneous to look at these and say, well, walking on ice is innocent, and going to a bar is innocent, and being out at 10 o'clock at night is innocent. You really have to look at the totality of the circumstances as a whole picture viewed through the eyes of an objective law enforcement officer. And I would submit that that's exactly what happened here, is the officer Kellerman pulled all the facts presented to him together, again, used his training experience, and came to the reasonable suspicion that the defendant had driven under the influence. Based on that, I feel the magistrate erred when she concluded that reasonable suspicion did not exist and her findings were erroneous. Barring any other questions, I think that's the bulk of my argument.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hall, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Officer Kelderman's initial observation on January 2nd that night was one of no impaired driving. He sees Mr. Aberg pull in, park perfectly. There's no signs of erratic driving. That should have led him to conclude that Mr. Aberg, in his experience, should have led him to conclude that Mr. Aberg was not under the influence of alcohol. But on a hunch, he decides to keep watching, and acting on his curiosity, he makes an approach and seizes Mr. Aberg outside the doors of the stoplight lounge. If the court is to overturn the trial court, the result would be that anyone who has a prosthetic leg or a similar disability and has difficulty walking would place themselves subject to seizure by law enforcement anytime they walked in public, anywhere they walked in public, whether the surface was icy or not.
Well, now, counsel, this wasn't 10 o'clock Sunday morning and the gentleman wasn't trying to go to church.
The location is that outside of the bar. At night. Regardless of that circumstance, Officer Kelderman's observation could include anybody. A bar is not an illegal place to go at 10 o'clock or any time the place opens. That one circumstance by itself is all that gives is a location of where the officer saw the stop. That by itself or in totality is not a criminal activity.
You know, I might agree with you. Up until the point that the officer makes a stop and asks him if he has any medical condition or if he's been drinking, as I recall, and the man admits that he's got a prosthetic leg and that he's had a couple of beers. Now, if it was just the leg, then I might agree with you that that would have been the something else that the officer in his experience and in his observations saw, because he gives the conclusion that it was something, that he was under the influence of something. And if the something is just the prosthetic leg, you know, that might be the end of it. But the man admits that he's had a couple of drinks, which, and then whether or not there was the smell of alcoholic beverages, that is something else and furthers it.
Justice Sabers, there's nothing in the record to support that the officer smelled intoxicants.
I agree with that. I didn't recall not seeing that either.
But he does make a statement that, Mr. Aberg makes a statement that he had a few drinks earlier in the day. Now, obviously, that's a large time span. This is 10 o'clock at night. The officer should not reach the conclusion that he's intoxicated based on a statement that he was drinking beer earlier in the day.
Could the officer have approached him and said, sir, are you in difficulty? And if the man says, no, I have a prosthetic leg, is that permissible? Or at what point does he have no right to even determine if the person needs help or where do we cut it off?
Chief Justice, if under these circumstances the officer did not have any type of basis to even approach Mr. Aberg. It was not a situation where Mr. Aberg was clutching his chest like he was having a heart attack. It wasn't a situation where he looked like he was in pain. It doesn't look like he was suffering any health crisis.
Well, the man almost, I beg to differ a little bit in the sense that the officer says that he was having real difficulty with it. He was holding his arms out like for balance and that he almost fell down. So that's enough for the officer, isn't it, to stop him and ask him if he's okay?
I would respectfully disagree that it's not, that under those circumstances alone, especially walking on a very icy surface, it's not unusual for any of us to be having difficulty walking on an icy surface. I know that there's many times I myself have walked on an icy surface gingerly, and then the next moment I'm looking up at the sky because I've fallen down. It's just those circumstances, holding his arms out, just indicates to me that somebody was trying to balance themselves on a very icy surface, and that's what the record indicates the officer saw that night, was a very icy surface. And in his, while watching Mr. Aberg approach the stoplight lounge, all he could describe was great difficulty walking. Now, in his police report, all he puts was great difficulty walking. At the suppression hearing, he adds the testimony that he staggered and almost fell down. Well, the trial court ruled on the credibility of Officer Kelderman.
He did not make a finding on the credibility.
That is correct, except for not on that specific issue. That is correct.
She never used the word credibility.
No, but the fact that she found that, the fact that the trial court found that the officer was acting on a hunch and acting on his idle curiosity lends to the fact that she discredits his testimony as far as the staggering and all
that. At this hearing, did you present either testimony from your client or by other means to challenge the credibility of the officer, or was that the only evidence the magistrate had?
That was the only evidence that the magistrate had.
As I understand it, too, this is not a community caretaker exception where the officer went over to find out if he was okay. The officer was going over to see if he had a potential crime in progress. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
The state didn't argue at any time that the officer was looking out for his welfare to see if he was all right.
That is absolutely correct. The state at no time ever challenged that this was a seizure, and no time ever challenged that or raised the issue of a community caretaker.
And what we have to focus on is what, as the state has pointed out, is what the officer knew before he actually did the stop, not what he found out afterwards. So the fact that he admitted to having some beers ahead of time has nothing to do with our analysis.
Precisely, Justice Meyerhenner. The issue is, what did the officer observe before making the illegal seizure? And all he could testify to what he observed was great difficulty walking, great difficulty getting out of his vehicle, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent explanations that don't reach the level of any type of criminal activity for any of those factors. One, it's an icy surface.
Well, just a minute. The U.S. Supreme Court has recently very clearly stated that you don't take it item by item and look to see if there are innocent circumstances. That's not the standard that's used.
Yes, sir, that is correct, Justice Enter. The standard is to look at the totality of the circumstances that happened that night, and not the state does not, or the officer does not, have to come up with an innocent explanation for each one. But they still have to clear the hurdle of reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal activity afoot. And the officer in this case could not even jump over those hurdles. First of all, Judge Irvine ruled that the officer could only make general and vague observations about what he saw that night. Those aren't and could not articulate the criminal activity that he suspected. Therefore, he couldn't even reach the hurdle, jump over that hurdle of reasonable and articulable suspicion that is required under the Fourth Amendment.
What is the legal significance of the fact that the officer did not know about the prosthesis? Your argument a few moments ago was that we'd be sending a message to anybody that has a prosthesis that they're subject to being detained. Now, the fact that the officer didn't know or misunderstood, that under the law, my understanding is, should not be held against a finding of reasonable suspicion.
Yes, that is correct. I think whatever he didn't find out about the prosthetic leg until after the illegal seizure, when he questioned him. Regardless of the prosthetic leg, his vague description of the activity that Mr. Abrick was, the characteristics of walking to the stoplight lounge were nothing more than walking with great difficulty. To have that be an inference of driving while intoxicated is unreasonable, and that's what the trial court determined. There's no clear error here in the record that based on the facts that the officer observed, whether or not he has a prosthetic leg or walks without any kind of normal change in his gait, there's nothing that he observed that would lead one to conclude that he was under the influence of alcohol, especially if you take into the totality of the circumstances the fact that it's very icy on that surface, the parking lot and on the city streets. And just because somebody has difficulty walking on ice should not place him under this umbrella of reasonable suspicion of any type of criminal activity.
It did lead him to conclude, though, that the person was under the influence of something, right? Either, just to shorten it up, either drugs or booze, I assume. Huh?
That was his subjective thought.
That was that's one spin. The other spin from the state is that it's an observation of a seasoned officer who, based on his experience, is making that judgment. And they do that all the time.
And based on what he observed, was nothing more unusual than anybody else walking on ice. And I guess that's my primary point. It would lead any officers to be able to seize.
No, but his observation was that it was something different than someone walking on ice. That's his observation, that's his experience, that's his statement. That the person almost fell down, that he was having great difficulty, he was, maybe excessively trying to balance himself. And it led him to the conclusion that it was something, that he was under the influence of something, but he didn't specify.
And it shouldn't have gotten that far. There's nothing in the record to show that he was intoxicated.
Well, what if the officer would have not stopped him, and then he left the bar a couple hours later and goes out and runs over somebody? Isn't that something that society would prefer to have the officer make a reasonably harmless stop, just to check out if the person is under the influence of something?
A DWI investigation, Justice Sabers, is one where it can mean prevention, absolutely. But here it's not as though the officer saw him coming from a bar to go to his car, as Justice Meyer Henry pointed out earlier. He was going from his vehicle to the bar. There's a whole host of explanations that are things that could occur afterwards. He could call a taxi, he could have a friend pick him up and take him home. The officer shouldn't be able to seize him just because he's going into a bar at 10 o'clock at night, based on these general observations of having difficulty walking on an icy surface. I understand that the policy of prevention of drunk drivers is certainly one that's a legitimate government interest, but that should be balanced against use the reasonable suspicion standard to balance the person's individual liberties against that. The officer has to have reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal activity before they can seize an individual under the Fourth Amendment. That balance should certainly weigh towards an individual's liberty and freedom against the legitimate government interest here, because the officer didn't have anything besides general observations of walking with difficulty.
Did the magistrate prepare the findings of fact and conclusions of law, or did you do it for her signature?
I did it for her signature.
Now, you could have included a specific finding of lack of credibility on the part of the officer's part, couldn't you?
Yes, sir, I could have.
That might have been determinative in this case, one way or another, right?
Looking back, I wish I had done some things differently. Yes, sir.
Okay.
But you don't know that she would have signed that either. I mean, judges don't simply don't sign what you put in front of them. She never mentioned anything about credibility, did she?
Nothing specifically, no, Your Honor, but I would defer to the court's finding of fact and conclusions of law in that she did find that the officer was acting on a whim and a hunch, and the observations he made that night were not supported by the reasonable suspicion standard.
And she made those findings on the record verbally?
At the suppression hearing, yes, sir. In conclusion, then, unless any other questions, I would just add that Officer Kelderman's intrusion on Mr. Aberg's privacy that night was not justified under these circumstances. The trial court got it right. The trial court did not err in concluding that reasonable suspicion did not exist to justify the stop of and detention of Mr. Aberg, and the trial court was correct under the law. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Blair, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd just briefly like to follow up on a few things. There was some talk about the important governmental interest in preventing drunk drivers. I think when you look at Terry, and the balance they try to strike with the language, the U.S. Supreme Court tried to strike with the language in that case, they recognized the important governmental interests that society has, governments have, in preventing crime, and they give that obligation to their law enforcement officers. And on the other hand, the court there recognized that citizens have the important interest in being free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The reasonable suspicion standard was created to allow law enforcement to carry out their obligation in preventing crime, but yet giving some sort of protection to the general public. The court could have set the standard at probable cause or much higher than the language in Terry and the cases that have flowed from there have set it at. It only requires specific and articulable facts along with the rational inferences from those facts that would lead an objective law enforcement officer to suspect criminal activity. And the officer doesn't even have to be right. He just has to have a reasonable suspicion of the activity. I think what plays into that is Justice Zinner's question about the legal significance of the prosthesis. If you look at the facts in hindsight, which I'm not asking you to do in making your decision, but Officer Kelderman was correct to suspect that the defendant was under the influence of something. At the time, Officer Kelderman had no idea that prosthesis existed. He observed the circumstances. He used his training experience to come to the inference that it was more than the ice, and he made the stop. Now, as far as the prosthesis and whether or not they smelled alcohol, that's the justification to continue the stop. I suggest the proper place to review that issue is before the magistrate or a different trial court to flesh out whether the continuation of the stop was reasonable or not. I will say that Officer Kelderman was within his authority as a law enforcement officer to make the stop of the defendant under the circumstances that he witnessed. The defense counsel likes to pull each fact out alone and offer innocent explanations for that. But Justice Zinner is correct that the federal courts have held that that's not the proper standard. It's not the innocent explanation standard. It's the reasonable suspicion standard. I think it's clear, based on the record and the standard, that Officer Kelderman was acting within his authority as a law enforcement officer, and that the stop of the defendant was indeed constitutional. I think it's clear that the magistrate erred in her findings and conclusions, and based on those errors, I respectfully ask that you overturn her suppression order and remand for further proceedings.
Do you concede that if the defendant had only admitted to the prosthesis and said nothing, and I don't believe there's anything in the record that's that relates to the officer smelling alcohol, but if he had not admitted that there were two, that he had a couple of drinks in the afternoon, and if he only admitted that he had a prosthesis, he had an artificial leg at the time of the stop, do you agree that the officer should have ended the stop, and then he had no further business inquiring further?
I would, under the exact same circumstances as there are now, accept the admission for drinking. Is that what you're asking?
No.
Or
excluding
just in general?
I'm giving you a little bit of a hypothetical.
Okay.
I want to know if you'll concede that without the admission of drinking, and without any reference to smelling alcohol, that if there's only admission of the statement of the artificial leg, should that have stopped the officer, and he should have not have proceeded any further with this?
I'm not a trained law enforcement officer, but if there's no other circumstance on the record that can support a reasonable suspicion conclusion, and the defendant states, I'm having difficulty walking because I have a prosthetic limb, then it would be my personal opinion that the officer should stop and end the contact at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
This does complete our term of court here. We're delighted to be back. We've held our March term of court, I think, since the 1970s at the law school, with the exception of last year, due to a disgruntled elevator, but that is now repaired, and it's just like coming home. All of us are alumni of this institution, and I look forward to this, and I hope you found it educational as well. I'd be remiss if I did not thank our hosts, the students of the law school, the dean and the president of the University of South Dakota, their staffs, our security, Lieutenant Jufer and Lieutenant Sheldon and the rest of the troopers, Vermilion Police Department, and the campus security here. That's not only to protect us, but it's to protect you folks too, so that you can use this as a learning environment. I'd like to thank the monitors that assisted us, and we hope to see you again next year. With that, the court is in recess.